WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. In his new book, The Culture of Disbelief, Stephen Carter argues that American law and politics have trivialized religious devotion. He fears that in our efforts to prevent zealots from dominating political discourse, we've become suspicious of anyone whose public opinions are shaped by religious values. Carter says in contemporary American culture, religion is often treated like a passing belief, almost like a fad, rather than as the fundamentals on which the religious build their lives. If we try to eliminate religious belief from public discourse, he says we're asking people to behave as if their faith did not matter to them. President Clinton has said this book lays out a lot of issues that he's trying to grapple with. Carter is a professor of constitutional law at Yale University. Carter says he's not trying to tear down the wall that separates church and state.
I'm a great believer in the separation of church and state. I think it's one of the great gifts that American politics has given to the world, even though it has fewer emulators than I think that it should. But it's important to understand what it means. The separation of church and state means that the government, especially through the schools, can't be in the business of endorsing particular religions or any or the idea of religion, promoting or coercing any kind of adherence. That's why, for example, organized classroom prayer in the public school is a bad thing. But I think we make a mistake when we talk, as some people do, as though arguing from religious premises for government action represents a violation of the separation of church and state. We mustn't try to come up with conversational rules for public debate that make our politics less welcoming to people who want to speak from their religious traditions.
You write that the consistent message of American society is that whenever the demand of one's religion conflicts with what one has to do to get ahead, one's expected to ignore the religion's demand and act, quote, rationally. What kinds of conflicts are you talking about there?
One of the stories I like to tell is a story of a friend of mine who was urged by a corporate headhunter to take his involvement with a religious organization off of his resume. He was told to have people think he had no religion at all than to have them think he was involved in some serious way with a religious organization. Very often people who want to follow the dictates of their religion in ways that are contrary to what most people think is the sensible thing to do are treated as odd, irrational, and they're sometimes punished. A few years ago, the Air Force disciplined an officer, for example, for wearing a yarmulke while in uniform in violation of military headgear regulations, which forbid the covering of the head indoors while in uniform. The message that sends is if you want to be a part of the Air Force, if you're part of the armed forces, don't be involved in a religion that has a tradition that makes you violate our headgear regulations, which are much more important. And if you were a rational person, you would understand that. The Congress sort of overturned that by statute, I should say, but they did it by adopting a statute that says that people in military uniform may wear religious apparel as long as the apparel, as the statute puts it, is neat and conservative.
As a constitutional lawyer and scholar, and as a religious person, do the laws of the country and your religious beliefs ever come into conflict?
That's a problem that a lot of believers face. It's not a problem I've had to face so far. I'm not saying there would be no laws that conflict with my religious beliefs, but simply it's not something that I've been called upon to act on. But it is interesting that we as a nation very often we're not very hospitable very often to people who want to argue that the laws of the nation conflict with their religious beliefs, especially if their concern is about their religious practices. The Supreme Court just this last year struck down an ordinance in the city of Hialeah, which was essentially an effort through the guise of a sham animal protection ordinance to prevent the practice of Santeria, which is a fusion of some Roman Catholic traditions and some of the Orisha traditions from Nigeria. It's an African-American religious tradition. Many people were offended because it involves animal sacrifice. The statute, the ordinances that Hialeah adopted allow many other people to engage to kill animals, but not for ritual religious purposes, at least not for the Santeria. rituals. That's an example of a kind of intolerance for people who have religious practices that are outside of the mainstream. Fortunately, the Supreme Court struck that down. It doesn't always do so. A few years ago, the Supreme Court upheld a decision by the Forest Service to build a road and allow logging in lands that were sacred to several Native American groups in California. The Native Americans argued that if the road building and logging were allowed, it would make it impossible to practice their religion. It would destroy their religious traditions. The Supreme Court said, in effect, that's just too bad. You lost in the democratic processes, and you have no recourse. The problem with that kind of approach is that religions in what sociologists refer to as the main line, that is, mainstream Protestantism, Roman Catholicism, and mainstream Judaism, all have enough political clout to, for the most part, protect themselves from state repression. But outsider religions, marginal religions, don't have that kind of political clout. And if they lose in politics and they get no protection from the courts, then there really is nothing to stand in the way of the state's effort to destroy them.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about religion and politics. You write that religion should be a bulwark against state authority, but we must guard against the likelihood that some religious people will use their religion as an instrument of oppression. How do you keep that balance?
It's not an easy balance to keep. One of the things I think that it's important to recognize is that it's a balance the courts can't keep very well. That is, the main bulwark against religious oppression, like the main bulwark against oppression of any other kind, is not the judicial system. It's the good common sense of the people of the United States. One of the reasons our history has often turned out so badly is that very often the people of the United States haven't shown much common sense or much sympathy. When they haven't done that, the courts have only rarely come to the rescue. But I think what one has to bear in mind is this, that there will always be people who will fight for causes that other people don't like. My claim is that the fact that people fighting for a bad cause use religious rhetoric doesn't make their cause more dangerous or more to be feared. One has to be sure, in criticizing a cause, that the cause itself is the enemy rather than the religious rhetoric is the enemy. Because if, as so often happens today, we treat religious rhetoric as the enemy, then we have no method for distinguishing between Martin Luther King Jr. and Pat Robertson. And it seems to me if we can't draw a distinction between them, then it's not clear what our politics are all about.
My guest is Stephen Carter. He's a professor of law at Yale University and author of the new book, The Culture of Disbelief, How American Law and Politics Trivialize Religious Devotion. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Carter, author of the new book, The Culture of Disbelief. Here's a thorny question. On the issue of creationism, and there are a lot of Christians who think that the schools should teach creationism and not evolution. You write, well, the schools shouldn't teach creationism because creationism is simply bad science. But on the other hand, if you're, you know, a person of faith and your faith tells you that, you know, man was created by God and, you know, it doesn't address the question of evolution, then why should you care what scientists say? Do you know what I'm saying? Your faith would take precedence over what the scientists say.
I really think the creationism battle is a much more difficult one than many people make it. Let me make clear, I'm not a scientific creationist. I don't buy their theories. I don't buy their science or their theology. I want my kids to learn the theory of evolution, which I believe is true. I don't want them to learn that human beings were suddenly created about 20,000 years ago, which is the theory of scientific creationism. But having said all that, I don't think the fact that someone disagrees with me and disagrees because of what their religious tradition has taught makes that person a dangerous religious fanatic. In my view, it makes them wrong in the sense that I think my science is better than theirs, but I don't think we should dismiss them blithely as some fanatic who's trying to capture the mechanisms of the public schools in order to proselytize. I think, rather, that we should recognize this is one of those horribly tragic situations in which we as a society make a choice. And we say one side wins and one side loses, and maybe it's one of the situations where one side's reasons won't convince the others. But I should say on the creationism point that one of the reasons that it's important not to dismiss the creationists as a fringe is that something like 48% of the American people say they believe the Genesis story of creation is literally true, and something like 70% of the American people say they think that creationism should be taught in schools alongside evolution. So when you say that it shouldn't be taught there, which is my position, you have to recognize you're going against the wishes of a large majority of the American people.
Yeah, but I guess this is where we're, well, I appreciate what you're saying very much, that, you know, you respect people's religions. And then there's the point at which you feel that you want to make sure that you or your children are not forced to behave in a way that contradicts either your own faith or your own freedom to choose to not have a faith. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah, well, let me look at the creationism thing a slightly different way. Let me put it a slightly different way. My answer to the creationism dilemma is that I think that parents should have a very broad right to have their children opt out of instruction in the public schools that they don't think is consistent with their religion. Now, some people say if you have this broad opt-out right for parents, that we'll become a nation of dunces. The kids won't learn anything in schools. I think that's probably not true. Even though 70% of the American people say they think creationism should be taught in the public schools, if it's not taught in the public schools, I don't think anything near 70% of the American people are going to take their kids out of the schools or out of those classes. So I don't think it's going to be a big problem. I think it's vital for us to have a core curriculum, some set of things that everybody has to learn, but I would want to define that as narrowly as possible, as opposed to letting each and each group get in, well, we need this and we need this, and this is in the core too. There should be a narrow core, and beyond that, I think you have to allow parents a broad opt-out right, because otherwise what you're telling them is, what we want to do is spend their tax dollars to teach your children that your religion is wrong. And that just strikes me as not a politically successful message, and not even a morally strong or a morally appealing message to send to parents. We should respect the parents' right to raise their children in their religious traditions, instead of looking, as I'm afraid the philosopher John Dewey did, instead of looking at the public schools as a way of weaning children away from their parents' religious traditions.
I'm interested where you stand on the question of medicine and religion, mm-hmm. when it's a question of, say, and this has happened several times recently, for instance, of a Christian Scientist parent, and Christian Scientists believe in Christian Science healing, you know, in a healing of faith, and they reject the use of medicine. So if a parent rejects the use of medicine for a child, or especially if the child is dying, should the courts intervene and demand that there be medical intervention, and that the doctors should be able to disregard what the parents believe and what the parents believe is best for their child?
You raise what I think is perhaps the single most difficult question that arises for those of us who think it's important to respect the rights of parents to raise children in their religion. And I think society, for better or worse, simply has to draw a line. That is, I think it's fine for parents to use the opt-out privilege I've described to protect their children in the public schools from things that the parents feel will make it harder to do religious teaching at home. I think it's fine for parents to make decisions as adults about their own health care based on their religious traditions. But I think that while I really believe we should go a great deal further than we do in accommodating differences in religious belief, I think one just has to draw a line and say there's a point at which we're talking about the well-being of a child, not simply in the sense of what are you learning in school, but is this child going to live or die?
The assumption in the mainstream with the Christian Science issue is that if the courts or some outside party doesn't intervene, then the child will die because this kind of faith will not heal the child. Only medicine will. But I think what a Christian Scientist would say is, you know, as far as they're concerned, faith often does heal, and people often die under a doctor's care. People often die in the hospital. You know what I mean? No matter what medical intervention has been tried, and that just the ultimate amount of cynicism is used when it comes to faith, and people are always giving medicine the benefit of the doubt.
Well, I think there's something to that. Death is one of the hardest things for many Americans to think about. And of course, for many people, religious traditions have mediated the human fear of death. And that's been an important part of our history. But it's interesting. If you look at the surveys A majority of Americans believe that God can heal diseases. A majority, a very strong majority of Americans will tell you that God works miracles today. And so although I quite recognize why our legal system really can't take that much into account, I think we should recognize also that parents who do think that perhaps their faith will heal their child, they're not outside the mainstream. They're not acting in a fashion that most Americans condemn. That's something most Americans believe is possible. That doesn't mean the parents ought to win. As I said, that's the point where you can't take a risk, and I understand that. Whatever the religious tradition may be, the point is that the parents who are trying to make this difficult judgment about the medical treatment for their child, even if their judgment is, we don't want medical treatment, and even if the state must overturn that judgment, the state should do so with reluctance. The state should do so recognizing that it is interfering with their religious life. And the state should also do so recognizing that it's not as though the parents are outside the mainstream, because parents who feel that way are not outside the mainstream.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed it.
Stephen Carter's new book is called The Culture of Disbelief. This is Fresh Air.